Bible Worm, Bible Worm, reading the Bible with Bible Worm.
Welcome to Bible Worm, getting to the core of the biblical text. I'm Dr. Robert Williamson, professor of religious studies at Hendricks College and the founding pastor of Mercy Community Church in Little Rock.
And I'm Dr. Amy Robertson, director of lifelong learning at Congregation Or Hadash in Sandy Springs, Georgia. We're here every week to discuss the biblical text, both as biblical scholars and as people of faith, one Jewish and one Christian.
This week, we discuss the story of Jesus calling his first disciples in Luke 5, 1-11. We think about Jesus teaching outside the synagogue and surrounded by the crowds, looking for a familiar face to accompany him in his ministry. We marvel at the response of Simon, James, and John, who set aside their tiredness and their obvious technical expertise to respond to the call of Jesus to go back out and drop the nets one last time. And we admire these men who look past their sudden economic boom and leave everything to follow Jesus. Also, we worry about the fate of the fish who were having a pretty good day until Jesus got involved. What does it mean to catch people like that? And do we really want to do that to them? Thanks for joining us. Hey, Amy, how are you this week?
I am doing all right.
So this week we're in Luke chapter 5, verses 1 through 11. This is the story of Jesus calling the first of his disciples. Anything that has happened since our attempted murder in Nazareth, where they try to throw him off? Is that too?
No.
Is that too harsh? Yeah. Last we spoke, they were trying to throw Jesus off a cliff, and he was passing through the midst of them.
You know, and then the narrative lectionary skips some like important stuff.
So, yeah, it does.
The second part of chapter 4 that we didn't read, Jesus is in Capernaum, mm-hmm. and he casts out a demon, which seems like kind of a big deal.
That's a big deal.
And then he also, my translation says he casts out a fever, which just kind of made me chuckle a little bit. Cast it out like a demon. Like, I wish I could cast fevers out of my children.
Yeah.
But then lots of people start coming to Jesus looking for healing, and mm-hmm. he does it. He heals lots of people. He casts out lots of demons. And then he says, but I've got more to do than help y'all in Capernaum, so I gots to go. But we're not reading those today.
We're not reading those. But there is one story in there that may be worth just mentioning, which is right in the middle of those two stories that you were talking about. There is the healing of Simon's mother-in-law. Mm-hmm. And we get that in chapter 4, 38 to 39. Simon's mother-in-law is sick with a fever, and Jesus goes over and speaks harshly to the fever. Oh, get out of here, fever. Uh-huh. And it left her, and she got up and served him. So this seems interesting to me because this is Simon Peter's mother-in-law, but we haven't actually met Simon Peter yet. We're going to meet him
okay,
in the next story.
Thank you for saying that, because first I was like, wait, is there a Simon and a Simon Peter? And I was trying to understand what was happening between the section that we're reading today and this section. And then just as you were talking, I was looking back to see if we had already met Simon and I forgot him.
Yeah.
We hadn't met him yet.
We haven't met Simon. And so this is the first thing we get from him is that his mother-in-law is healed by Jesus. And then we meet him again in the story we're about to read.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that's interesting to me in this text is what are Simon Peter's motivations for following Jesus, and having that piece as a back in the backstory kind of changes the way you answer that question, or at least it does for me.
Mm-hmm.
So picking up in Luke chapter 5, verse 1, I'm reading the Common English Bible today. One day Jesus was standing beside Lake Gennesaret when the crowd pressed in around him to hear God's word. Jesus saw two boats sitting by the lake. The fishermen had gone ashore and were washing their nets. Jesus boarded one of the boats, the one that belonged to Simon, then asked him to row out a little distance from the shore. Jesus sat down and taught the crowds from the boat. Okay, so here we have Jesus just commandeering a sea vehicle. How do you picture this scene of Jesus hopping on this boat, floating out in the lake?
That's a good question, but can I back up for a minute? Because I have a question before that, even before we get to verse 2.
Wow, yes.
I have a question about verse 1. Or an observation. So I think this is the first time we're seeing Jesus teaching outside a synagogue.
I think that's right.
I think he's just outside by the lake.
Yeah.
And so many people come seeking out his teaching. You know, like if you're in a synagogue, especially, you know, in the last chapter, it was on the Sabbath.
Yeah.
I think they said that he was teaching the synagogue. So you kind of have like a ready-made audience.
Right.
And here he's just outside and there are so many crowds coming to hear him that it's like, I don't know, I get this very like claustrophobic kind of sense from being in this crowd.
Yeah.
And then it tells us they came to hear the word of God.
Yeah.
What do you think that is? Like, is that the Torah? Is that an interpretation of the Torah? Is that like a prophetic something else?
I wonder if it's sort of intentionally vague. Mm. So yes, on the one hand, he's preaching from the Torah or the prophets, which we've seen him do previously.
Mm-hmm.
Secondly, I mean, Jesus is somehow communicating from God more directly than other people. Mm-hmm. And so maybe Luke means that when you hear Jesus speak, you are hearing the words of God.
That's interesting. Yeah.
So now my question about the boats. Jesus just commandeers these boats. And I'm just trying to imagine like what, like imagine that you're one of the
boatmen,
fisher people. Yeah. One of the boatmen. Uh-huh. Jesus hops on your boat.
So first I have to say that this, like this whole scene for me is just totally the like small church pastor or small synagogue rabbi who has to run their own sound system. Like, all right, Jesus, figure it out. Like, you have no one to help you with the logistics of this situation. And there's so many people and they can't hear you and they're all up in your business. So he finds a solution and it's commandeering a boat.
This is one of the places where the question of do Simon and Jesus have a previous relationship is interesting to me.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you just read this, as he hopped on a boat and it happened to be Simon's boat, and then Simon responds to him this way. To me, that reads in one kind of a way, where if you're like, no, Jesus actually knew Simon from the previous chapter
mm-hmm.
when Simon's mother-in-law was sick and the family called Jesus and said, can you heal her? And he healed her. And that changes the way that I read this text a little bit, because now Jesus sees the boat of a guy that he knows
mm-hmm.
and Simon sees Jesus who has done this thing for him.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're trusting each other a little bit
mm-hmm.
based on a prior relationship rather than just an encounter of random strangers.
And reading it that way for me sort of brings out this human element of vulnerability that Jesus may feel in this moment, that there's an overwhelming number of people and he doesn't know any of them and they're not trying to hurt him.
Right.
But that's a lot to manage. So I can sort of picture this scene where Jesus would like cast his eyes about and see one familiar face. And even though he may not have a relationship going way back with this person, that's more that like, I don't know. It feels like this human, like, okay, at least I've met you before.
Yeah.
Like I've got to throw my lot in somewhere here because I need backup. And so I choose you.
I like that interpretation. Okay. So picking up then in verse 4, when he finished speaking to the crowds, he said to Simon, row out farther into the deep water and drop your nets for a catch. Simon replied, Master, we've worked hard all night and caught nothing, but because you say so, I'll drop the nets. So they dropped the nets, and their catch was so huge that their nets were splitting. They signaled for their partners in the other boat to come and help them. They filled both boats so full that they were about to sink.
It's just funny to me that Jesus finishes talking and then is like, well, let's go fishing.
Yeah.
Like, we're in a boat. We have nets. Let's go.
Let's do it. Yeah. I love Peter's response. We've worked like, hi, random preacher man. We, the professional fishermen, I've been working hard all night and, you know, we know what we're doing. Mm-hmm. We've done this a lot and we've caught nothing. But because you say so, I'll drop the nets. And I go back and forth between whether, if you could hear Simon's tone right there,
mm-hmm.
whether it's like a fascination and deep obedience or whether it's like, all right, Mr. Man, well, because you say so, we'll drop the nets. I think Simon's got just a little hint of an eye roll going on right there.
He's probably pretty tired, too. Like, really, we're going to go fishing now? You commandeered my boat to give your lecture.
Yeah.
And now you want me to take you fishing. Okay.
I think that's important that, you know, these guys are, they're described as partners. So there's some sort of a fishing partnership. They're like small business owners. They've got their little fishing business that they run. They've had a terrible night. They've been out working all night. They've got nothing to show for it. They're tired. They were already washing off their nets. Like, they're ready to go home. And here's this guy who is, you know, I mean, he's preaching, which is important, but maybe it's not the first thing on their minds. And then he's pushing them back out into the water.
I mean, just the detail that they had already cleaned the nets. And then he says, drop the nets again. Like, oh!
Yeah, yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, do you fish?
I mean, no. Like, I have been fishing, but I'm not a, one would not describe me as someone who fishes.
I feel like the import of this story is a little lost on me because I have never been fishing. So, like, I don't know the thrill of a catch and I don't know the disappointment of a night of empty nets. And I don't know what it feels like in your body. And I don't know what feels like skill versus magic in catching fish or luck or I don't know. So we're going to rely on your fisher knowledge.
There's a few things that I think even a Bible scholar like me could say and be not totally wrong. One of them is oftentimes when we think about fishing, well, when I say we, I mean people who don't know that much about fishing. But we think of it first as recreational, like let's go out to the river or get our boat out on the lake and let's see what we can catch.
Yeah.
We also tend to think of it as like something you do with a line and a hook.
Yeah.
This is neither one of those things. That's this is let's see how many fish we can haul into a net because that's how we make our living. Like that's how we feed our families. Mm-hmm. So this is there's an economics to this and there's also a it's a group of fish. It's not an individual fish, which I think is going to maybe be important a little bit later. But I do think there is a sense in which fishing, whether it's recreational or professional, there's a sense of artistry to it. So you kind of know where the fish are likely to be and you have a sense of, you know, what need, you know, it's not just pure luck whether fish swim into your net or not, but having a sense of which parts of the lake they tend to congregate in and what kind of water are they attracted to and what kind of day or the time of day are they most active. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so there's a level of skill. And, you know, when I read this, I think Simon has that level of skill and he knows he has it. And Jesus has given no indication that he has that kind of skill. Mm-hmm. And so it's interesting here that Simon, the professional fisherman, is willing to follow the lead of this preacher because, I mean, I don't know why because. Because he healed his mother-in-law, because he said some interesting things in the boat, because he's a nice guy and just is willing to do stuff for people, because he thinks Jesus might have something in store for him that he doesn't know what it is. Mm-hmm. I'm so curious what's going on in Simon's mind when he accepts this invitation.
It's a really good question. And I just can't imagine that it's that Simon would do this for anyone.
Yeah.
Like it has to have something to do with the special nature of Jesus, whether it is the healing that he performed or the type of teaching he was doing, or, you know, maybe Simon was, well, I was going to say maybe he was a pious Jew, although he goes on later to say he's not.
Well, maybe that's what he says. We'll talk about that.
Yeah. We'll talk about what that is. Yeah. I don't know Simon.
Yeah.
I can't imagine he would do this for anybody. He's worked all night and he already cleaned his nets.
One other little detail that I find kind of interesting is I was reading a commentary from Joel Green on Luke. And one of the points that he made, and I'm totally relying on him here, is that the nets that they were using would have been linen nets that were visible to fish in the daytime. But fish would not have been able to see them at night when it's dark because there's nothing to reflect off the linen.
Okay.
But in the daytime, the fish would be like, hey, there's a net over there. And so if that is true, then what Jesus is asking them to do is like doubly ridiculous because they already have been fishing all night. And also now they're fishing in a way that the fish can totally just see what they're doing.
I keep thinking back to your comment that, you know, that fishing was an economic activity.
Yeah.
When Simon did it. But when Jesus does it, it's not. Presumably, it's not an economic activity, which just draws me back to the conversation that, you know, you keep bringing back to the center here, that there are economic and political ramifications to Jesus's ministry.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah,
that's right.
Like, just reading there and stopping, like, it doesn't, like, their boats are now sinking. They have so much fish in them, which yeah. I guess is, I mean, again, I have got to, this section of text keeps, like, refocusing me, like, keep your eye on the prize here. Like, I keep thinking, well, I don't want my boat to sink because it has yeah. so many fish in it. That is not the point of the story. You know, like, the point is the enormity of, I guess, Jesus's power. To be able yeah. to catch so many fish without any particular fishing skill set during the day with a linen net, like so much that it weighs down yeah. your boats and they start to sink. The point is not great. We can like sell all these fish and have a great lunch like that. That's not the point.
Well, I mean, it might be the point, though. It's not clear to me that that's not the point. I mean, at the end of the day, that's not the point. But like in the narrative flow, I think that could well be the point is, you know, this is the best day this little fishing mm-hmm. business has ever had, right? Mm-hmm. Like they've been struggling along. They worked all night with nothing to show for it. And now they've got so many fish that they've got to have two boats completely full and they could not be any fuller. Like they literally, if they had caught another fish, then one of their boats would have sunk, you know?
Yeah.
And so this, they have maximized productivity in that sense. Like that's a big day for your, yeah. for your business.
Yeah.
So the last thing on this section is the first thing Jesus says to them is row out into the deep water.
Mm.
Do you have any thoughts about to what extent ought we read that as metaphorical or theologically significant?
I mean, it has so much resonance for me. In the religious world, you know, as a to go out into the deep, the like the abyss, the tahom in Hebrew, like this yeah. sense of like bottomless deep water that is terrifying, that yeah. can swallow you whole, that you don't know what's in there. Probably a sea monster's in there. And also, you know, if they were like just knee deep in the water to try to get away from the people a little bit, there probably aren't going to be any fish there. So yeah. like for practically speaking, then yeah, you probably also have to move further out if you want to do the fish demonstration that Jesus wants to do.
Yeah.
So I guess what I would say is that it resonates at both levels. Like, I don't think that we should read this story and say that it doesn't, that there's no practical purpose for rowing out to the deep. I think there probably right. is a practical purpose, but I certainly think that we can think about the resonance of deep water.
I like what you were emphasizing about the water, both as source of life and also source of danger. So when you row out into the deep, you are, you know, you're more at risk than you are when you're right next to the shore.
Mm-hmm.
But also that's where the fish are.
And right. so
the potential for life is out in the places where there is danger.
Yeah.
And those two things kind of come together.
Yeah.
I like that a lot.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's see the response of Peter and his friends, starting in verse 8. When Simon Peter saw the catch, he fell at Jesus' knees and said, "Leave me, Lord, for I am a sinner." Peter and those with him were overcome with amazement because of the number of fish they caught. James and John, Zebedee's sons, were Simon's partners, and they were amazed too. Jesus said to Simon, "Don't be afraid. From now on, you will be fishing for people." As soon as they brought the boats to the shore, they left everything and followed Jesus.
This cry from Simon is so poignant and beautiful.
Yeah.
Like I can just feel his recognition that something really holy, really yeah. godly, really powerful is right up next to him.
Yeah.
And he feels like he doesn't belong there. Like I have this image of like an Israelite wandering into the temple and all of a sudden being like, "Oh crap. Like
yeah.
I don't belong here."
No, I think that's exactly right. And you're gesturing there, I think, toward the story we did a few months back on Isaiah 6, where that's exactly what happens. Isaiah wanders into the temple, the seraphim show up. Isaiah sees the Lord mm-hmm. sitting in the temple. And the first thing he says is, "Woe is me, for I am a man of unclean lips."
Yeah.
This story seems like a retelling of that story, I think. Instead of seeing the seraphim and God seated on the throne, what Peter sees is Jesus causing a miraculous catch of fish. And he's able to make that move and realize what he has seen. And his response is exactly the same. I don't know if it's exactly the same, but it is recognizably similar to Isaiah. Yes. I have unclean lips. I am a sinner. And he shows proper obeisance. He falls down to his knees and he says, I'm a sinner. Like, I don't deserve to be here. And he refers to Jesus as Lord, Kyrie.
Yeah, and I think it's really interesting to think about the situation that Isaiah was in where he came to realize that versus the situation that Simon is in, and that Simon's able to recognize that, you know, that he recognizes this, or maybe Jesus knew that this was the thing that would cause Simon to recognize his power in the world. I don't know. It's like they're speaking the same language here. And Simon understands from this act that he is here in a boat with, I don't know if he thinks it's God, God's self, but someone awfully holy, someone categorically different than he is.
I love that way of describing it, that Jesus has spoken Simon's language here. Instead of preaching to him about what Jesus is, he demonstrates in the language, so to speak, of Simon's trade. Mm-hmm. I love that way of thinking about it.
Which is so interesting because I often give Jesus sort of a hard time for not speaking in ways that people can understand. Yeah. But in this case, he very much speaks in a way that Simon can understand.
Now, what Peter says is, leave me, for I am a sinner. And I'm just curious what you think, like, like that's sort of a... I mean, that's sort of a strange thing to say, like, wow, get away from me, you. And so I'm just curious what you think is going on with Peter right in that moment.
I mean, I guess I take from it this idea that Simon, maybe at this point, you know, we mentioned earlier in the story, we're not sure if Jesus has specifically chosen Simon's boat or he just got in a boat and it was Simon's. But Simon seems to feel at this point sought out.
Yeah.
And so he's saying, stop pursuing me. Like, I'm not who you think I am.
Hey, you had said something earlier that I was curious about. You said that Simon is not a very observant Jew. And was that related to this?
It was. And now I take it back. When I first read this, I read it as, you know, I go gamble on the weekends and I do, you know, like I do this sort of, you know, the traditional sins.
Yeah.
But now reading it over with you and thinking about proximity to holiness and Isaiah's experience, I don't think it necessarily implies that Simon's doing anything out of the ordinary. He might be a pious guy, but even as a pious guy, we're still not built to be around that kind of holiness.
The word that gets used there of Peter and then of James and John, who we're just getting their names for the first time, even though they've been in this story this whole time. The word used there is amazement. They were overcome with amazement.
Like Mary.
Yeah. Can you say more about that connection? I think that's a really interesting one.
I mean, when we encountered Mary's amazement earlier in the gospel, what I remember of our conversations was that she saw something that she understood was incredible and that she understood she couldn't really understand, you know? And so it would describe her amazement and say that she just held on to it. Like she just held on to, she treasured that thing, even though she couldn't quite parse it up and, you know, figure it out. So it's interesting now to see that same kind of response, that amazement coming from these couple of fishers who have just met Jesus just now. And I don't know, I guess I just take it as almost like this moment of pause where like they don't know what they've seen.
Yeah.
You know, like they don't. They're like, oh, this means such and such. Like they don't have that. It's just, I don't know. It's like time sort of stops and you can just like sit in the enormity of this. It's like the wow moment.
I want to give credit to these guys because there's a version of this story, which would not probably be in the Bible, but in which what they are amazed by is, I mean, they are amazed by how many fish they have caught.
Yeah.
But what they do with that is to be amazed with Jesus. Instead of to be amazed by like how many fish they now have, right?
Right.
Like they could be rushing off to the market.
Yes.
To sell their fish.
Yes.
But that's not what captures their imaginations. What captures their imaginations is the power of this guy who's in their boats. And it takes a certain level of, I don't know, insight or faithfulness or something to not get distracted by the economic boom that they just experienced.
You're right. Yeah. Because they were just trying to get these fish themselves.
Yeah.
And it would be easy for them to focus on the amazement of just, we got the fish, and then the story ends there. You know, like, yeah. Thanks so much, Jesus. See you later.
Yeah.
Yeah, but the fact that Simon immediately says, go away from me, for I'm a sinful man.
Yeah.
You know, cues me that his attention is on Jesus, not on the fish.
Now, what Jesus says then back to Simon is, don't be afraid. From now on, you will be fishing for people. The Greek there is catching people alive.
Ah! Oh my God, that's worse. <There's> yeah.
You'll be netting folks. Oh, yeah.
That's so creepy. That's such a creepy thing to say. That's creepy. Yeah.
So let's unpack your creeped-outedness, and then we'll talk a little bit about what we think Jesus actually was trying to say.
Okay.
Or maybe those are the same thing. I don't know.
I mean, like, fish don't want to be caught.
Yeah.
It's not like the fish are getting saved from something and are going to lead a much better life now that they're in a net.
Right.
It's probably, it's like their worst day, the day you get caught in the net.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that's it. So it's really hard. I mean, I know that's not the point of this.
Yeah.
But it's such a creepy image to me.
Yeah.
Like, we're going to catch people who are going about their lives perfectly happily, and we're going to trap them.
No, I think what you're saying is really important. And I mean, it's...
I don't think it's that important. I think I need to get over it.
At one level, like, you know, metaphors all have their limitations.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so if you read the other side of this metaphor, which is, what is it like to be the fisher person, then it's a really great metaphor, right? Mm-hmm. In the same way that you are now able to catch all of these fish, now you're going to be able to go out in the world and you're going to be able to do the same thing, but with people. Mm-hmm. And that's going to be amazing, and you're going to be great at it, and I've shown you what I can do, so let's go do this thing. And so if you just read that side of the metaphor, which is, I think, what Luke and Jesus intends for us to do, then what you've got is there's going to be a bountiful ingathering, and it's going to be wonderful for everybody. But I think what you're pointing out is important, too, that there is another side of the metaphor. And in the same way that there's another side to the metaphor, there is also another side to the actual practice of evangelizing or proselytizing. And there are people who don't, like, yeah, like, there is, like, fishing is an aggressive thing to do to a fish, you know? Mm-hmm. And so I think there's a warning when you read the flip side of the metaphor, which you're doing, for people about how to go about this process of proclaiming the gospel, and that it can be really damaging to people. Mm-hmm. I don't think Luke wants us to be thinking about that right now.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But I think it needs to be thought about.
That's really helpful to me.
Now, the last verse then tells us that they get the boats back to shore and they left everything and followed Jesus.
Yeah.
So the image that's in my head is that they're these two boats full to sinking of fish, and that they've just left that sitting on the shore. Seems like they've left their homes. They've left their families. They've left all the things. That's an amazing reaction. What do you have thoughts about that? The way that response becomes like an immediate like handing over of everything?
I mean, it would be easy, I think, for me to critique it.
Yeah.
But I think it's more important for me to sit in like the enormity of their experience. Like, maybe whether or not it's clear to me as a reader of this story that this is what they should have done, as people living in this story, it sure was clear to them.
Yeah.
You know, and I know there are moments in all of our lives where it's just clear and you can't necessarily explain to someone else how it came to be clear or why it's clear, but it just is. And so that, for me, again, just sort of like almost like Simon's sudden statement, like, go away from me because I'm a sinful man. You realize that he has understood something about what's happening here.
Yeah.
They have understood something from this experience. They did not start parsing out the metaphor in this like OCD way that I did as like, you know, a reader, as an outsider to this text.
Yeah.
I don't know. I think it's a great testament to their clarity.
Yeah.
What do you think about it?
No, I love all of that. The thing that's so striking to me, and I mean, even the way that I asked the question shows that this is what's striking to me, but there is an economics in this passage. Mm-hmm. And then there is a faithfulness in this passage. Mm-hmm. And those two things are directly in conflict at the end of the story, mm-hmm. in which these guys have had the best day of their careers. Like, they are on the verge of doing something amazing here. They've got the biggest catch you could get. They've got, you know, they just got to go to the market and sell these fish, and they're set for the season, you know? And instead, they leave it all there, and they walk away. Mm-hmm. Like, there's something going on in this text about following Jesus in this way that Jesus wants to be followed involves leaving behind the profit of your professional life. You cannot simultaneously be succeeding in the economics of the empire and succeeding in the economics, so to speak, of the kingdom of heaven. You've got to pick one or the other. And these guys pick one, and in this kind of dramatic way, they leave the other one sitting on the shore. Mm-hmm. You know, there are consequences to choosing this life, which are pretty significant consequences. And these guys just do it.
Yeah.
Okay, Amy, so when you're thinking about this story and the places that it intersects with contemporary life, where is your head going in terms of the significance of this story for today?
What I am struck by, honestly, is my own vanity in reading this story. And like, it, I don't know that it like hurts my feelings that I want to be more than a million random fish.
Yeah.
You know? And part of that, I can say, like, okay, I've really swallowed that narrative of, like, you've got a friend in Jesus, and, like, those, like, cartoons where, like, Jesus is at the dentist with you. Have you seen those? Have you, like, where Jesus is, like, with you waiting to hit the ball at a baseball game?
Yeah.
But that's not what this chapter is about. That's not what this story is about. And this story is, this story is much more about, like, the magnitude of the project. And maybe Jesus works on both those levels at the same time. But as you were just talking about the decision of the fishers to leave everything, like leave not just their like economic, the potential for economic prosperity, but all of their responsibilities, you know, to leave their families, to leave, there are all these fish in the boats now that could feed all these hungry people. At least give away the fish before you leave. Like, there's just a total, it feels like a total abandonment of earthly stuff.
Yeah.
That on the one hand seems crazy to me. And on the other hand, just sort of underscores again that I don't really, it's hard for me to get it. It's hard for me to really inhabit this story and envision like this, like an awareness of some like stream of holiness, like on the earth. That you can tap into. Like, of course you would leave your earthly responsibilities to be able to engage with that, to be sort of part of that project. But it's hard for me to wrap my head around it. And that makes me think that I am a vain person. I don't know. It's hard. It is. This is as like an American individualist who wants a personal relationship or whatever. Yeah. That's in other stories. That is not in this story. This story is not about the personal relationship. The story is the enormity of the project that Jesus has before him.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And one of the things that I say this often, but one of the things I love about reading with you is that you're always empathizing with the people in the story that you're not supposed to empathize with. And here you're empathizing
like
with the
fish. What about the
Yeah, but I think that's totally a reasonable thing to do. This is a great story if you read it from the perspective of the fisherman, but if you read it from the perspective of the fish, it takes on a whole different nuance.
That's true. And it's so interesting. Like, I didn't even really try to read it from the perspective of the fisherman.
Yeah.
I'll try that later.
That's so amazing.
Where does this text bring you, Bobby?
The thing that I've been thinking about this time is how amazing the response of Peter in particular, but also James and John is prior to that last moment where they leave everything behind. Mm-hmm. And by that, I just mean that there are so many opportunities in this text for them to have missed what was happening right in front of them. They were tired at the end of the day. They could have just said, you know what, man, good luck to you preaching to this crowd of people. But we're going home. Mm-hmm. They could have said, we let you use our boat to talk, but we are not getting
our nets back out.
And we're not going back out there again.
We're done.
They could have said, our expertise as fishermen is so superior to your expertise as a preacher of the gospel or whatever, that we know that we can't catch any fish because we've been trying all night. And are you crazy to think we could use this reflective net in the daytime when all the fish are just like, hey, there's a net? There are so many reasons for them not to have done what Jesus is asking them to do.
Mm-hmm.
And instead of doing that, they just, I mean, and I don't even quite know why, but they just trust that maybe their expertise, maybe their tiredness, maybe their sense of what, you know, they're capable of doing, they just don't let it get in the way of this experience that they are having. And when the fish get gathered in, they don't think, yeah, what a catch. You know, we can go sell these and we're set for life or whatever. Like, I don't know how much money they would have made off these fish, but it would have been significant. They say, oh my goodness, this man is holy. And I just, it's amazing to me, like how many places in there I think I would have gone off the rails and gotten distracted by either by my tiredness or by my expertise or by, you know, my future potential income.
Right.
And they hold the course. So in my mind, there's the hard message in this text, which is, I mean, they're all hard messages in this text, but there's the like message at the end, which is if you really want to be part of this kingdom of God thing, you've got to be willing to leave everything behind and follow. Like, I think that's where this text ends up. Leave behind the economics of the empire, follow the economics of the kingdom of heaven. Can you do that? But even before you get to that message, there's this thing about when you're living your daily life, what are you paying attention to? What are you thinking about? What possibilities are you open to? To what degree does your sense of your own expertise or the like limits of your workday or your tiredness, to what extent does that limit you from encountering people or in encountering the presence of God in your midst? And how could we go about life with this kind of openness that these fishermen display for no apparent reason? So that's kind of where I am, is like, okay, on a day-to-day basis, what does this mean? And it means setting aside some of my own sense of importance and the busyness of daily life and just paying attention to the people and the places, the things that are unfolding around me, and having some imagination about what might be possible instead of always thinking about what is not possible. And here's the five reasons why I can't do that.
I love that. I really love that. And it makes me think of a student I'm working with right now, a 12-year-old who's about to celebrate her bat mitzvah and is writing her Devar Torah about God in the world and, you know, how does God communicate with us now and sort of the old traditions of prophecy and whatnot. And we've had a lot of interesting conversations about what it is we think we know now that makes us no longer feel a sense of amazement.
Yes.
Or wonder or possibility or, you know, and how we can cultivate that, like how we can open up space for things to be amazing again, instead of, you know, I have my schedule and I'm sticking to my stuff and I'm just going to try to, you know, control my day here. I really love that. I love that.
Okay, Amy. So next week we're going to be in Luke chapter 6, verses 1 to 16. Where we get some healing on the Sabbath, and then Jesus is going to call the rest of the 12 apostles.
I'll be here.
All right. I'll see you then.
Good to see you.
Bye. Thanks for joining us for this episode of Bible Worm. If you'd like to hear the rest of our conversation about this text, join our Patreon at the Extended Worm level or higher to get access to extended episodes. You'll also find other goodies like early access, video lectures, weekly liturgies, and more, starting at just $4 per month. Visit patreon.com/Bibleworm podcast for details.
Bibleworm is produced by Bobby Williamson and edited by Joel and Laura Becker. Our theme song is sung by Colin Bagby. We are so grateful to all our supporters for helping us to keep the podcast going. A special thank you to our executive producer, Fox Valley Presbyterian Church in Geneva, Illinois, and to our newest sponsors, Trisha Dillon Thomas, Kira Miller, Leslie Roper, and Sharon Brown.
Join us again next week when we'll be discussing Luke 6, 1 to 16, the story of Jesus healing on the Sabbath. Until then, keep on digging.